raised his weapon, and Yuan leapt on him, bringing him to the ground and driving the knife low, just above the groin, under Andy's body armor. He sank it to the hilt, then ripped left and right, tearing through Andy's internal organs. Andy screamed, beating him on the head. Johan heard firing behind him, the room exploding into noise. He slid his left hand up Andy's body, catching him under the chin and pushing out, exposing Andy's neck. Johan jerked the knife free, batted Andy's hands aside, and slit his throat from ear to ear. He rolled over, snatched Andy's rifle, and rose to a knee, seeing Chris firing at the security man. A bullet hit Chris in the thigh, flinging his leg backward like it had been hit with a bat. He dropped to the ground face first, and Johan saw multiple rounds tear into the gaps in his armor around his shoulders and neck, a final one cratering his skull. Johan got in the fight, squeezing the trigger in controlled pairs and taking the life of the security man. The other three surrounded Lanatha, pulling him back to the security point and focusing on Johan. He swiveled his weapon, knowing he was dead, and Pike Logan's team poured through the terminal door, killing every threat in their path. In the span of a single trigger pull, all three security men were lifeless. Lanatha fell to his knees with his hands covering his head. Johan scanned the room and saw Armstrong running past the security metal detectors toward the front of the terminal. He leapt up and said, "I've got him," and gave chase. He reached the entrance lobby of the airport and caught sight of Armstrong running past the single check-in counter. He fired over his head and shouted, "Armstrong, next one will be in you." Armstrong stopped, then slowly turned around, his hands in the air. Johan motioned, and Armstrong walked to him. He put his hands down and said, "I suppose you'll kill me now." "No, I have something more important in mind." Armstrong heard the words, and a sneer spread across his face, his confidence growing. He said, "Still the Lily Boy. Sure. Something more important. Maybe you just don't have the stomach for this work." Johan hammered the butt of his cig into Armstrong's face, shattering his nose. Armstrong dropped to the ground. Johan said, "Stomach that, you fuck." Armstrong moaned, and Johan said, "Get the fuck up." Armstrong rose, holding his bloody face, and Johan pushed him with his foot, forcing him back into the waiting area. When they arrived, Johan saw a new cluster of men, all wearing police uniforms except one. Lanatha was on his knees, his hands cuffed behind his back. The police circled around him. One cop smacked him in the head, and the man called Thomas waved his hand, saying, "No more violence. We don't do that anymore. Let the law take care of him." Lanatha looked up and said, "Who are you?" Thomas glanced at Pike, and Pike nodded. He said, "Thomas Naboni." He had trouble getting the next words out, but finally did. "The man who is now in charge." Pike said, "Good. Good. Thomas, it's your show now. Good luck." Surprised, Thomas said, "That's it?" Pike smiled and said, "That's it. We've got an aircraft inbound. We'll be taking Armstrong with us, but the rest of this is up to you."
"What if the fighting continues?"
"It won't. Masebo's dead, and you now control the police. You'll have a ton of U.S. Marines here in short order. I'd recommend, as a first step, getting in touch with the U.S. Embassy for coordination. Get them on your side early."
"Can't you do that? Can't you stay and help?"
His face was so earnest it caused Jennifer to come forward. She said,
"Thomas, you have all the help you need. The people love you. You'll be fine."
But I could use your help. I mean, I trust you. The people will trust you, and so will the Americans at the embassy. I need you to talk to them.
Pike chuckled and said, "Don't read into our reputation. Just being an American won't help here. I don't think you want me speaking to the embassy. They won't take kindly to us being here. In fact, it'd be good if you just didn't mention us at all." Confused, Thomas said, "Why? After all you've done here to bring about justice?" Shoshana said, "Because Pike's an asshole. Nobody likes him." Knuckles laughed and said, "Thomas, justice is in the eye of the beholder. Trust me when I say the embassy will not appreciate our efforts. Leave us out of this, and make it all internal to Lesotho. You do otherwise, you bring us into this, and it becomes complicated. Let it go." Thomas reluctantly nodded, and Johann said, "I'll stay." Pike looked at him in surprise, and he said, "Least I can do. I'd rather be here working with Thomas than wherever you're taking Armstrong. I told you I'd set you free." He said, "I trust you, Pike, I do, but I don't trust whomever you work for. And besides, I think Thomas could use the help. I'm from South Africa. I know the continent." Thomas nodded and said, "Thank you. I appreciate it." Pike shook his head but understood the sentiment. He said, "As long as you stay on the right side." Johann said, "Just get those triggers. Promise me that." Pike looked at Armstrong and said, "Of course. That's what this whole thing has been about." Shoshana smiled, and Johann knew why. Pike was stretching the truth to the breaking point. Pike looked at Armstrong and said, "But those triggers will be the easy part. Isn't that right, Colonel?"
87. I took another sip of my giant hurricane. If you ordered the big one, you got to keep the glass, and saw Tyler Malloy enter the restaurant. It was okay to booze it up now, because my team wasn't in on the hunt. That had all been turned over to the proper authorities, and the restaurant was now surrounded by State Department diplomatic security services and the FBI. Because of Tyler's status as a U.S. citizen, the task force had been pulled from the operation. But nobody could tell me I couldn't get an American hamburger at an American restaurant, which was why I was pleased Tyler Malloy had chosen the Hard Rock Cafe for his transfer. Hell, our waitress was even from Texas. Long story once I asked her, but fascinating all the same. It had been 3 days since the L-100 had landed on Lesotho airfield, and so far, things seemed to be going splendidly for Thomas Naboni. The mighty U.S. Marine Corps had landed about 6 hours after we'd left, and had pretty much secured the entire city from any threats, giving the Lesotho police and military a helping hand at crowd control, all coordinated through the U.S. Embassy. Unfortunately, by the time they'd begun operations for the removal of U.S. citizens, the shooting was all over, and the people refused to leave. The commander of the Marine Corps task force had been bitching holy hell, trying to put his finger on the idiot who had demanded the NEO. The embassy said it wasn't them, even as they coordinated a response. In their defense, they'd mentioned one wounded person, an Israeli no less, and a hysterical woman who demanded protection for a children's hospital. She had disappeared in the chaos, and nobody even remembered her name. Nobody seemed to know how the rumor of threats to U.S. citizens had snowballed into a deployment order. Well, one person knew. Colonel Kurt Hale, and he was none too happy. We'd boarded the L-100, dragging Armstrong with us, and I was surprised to find Blaine Alexander on the bird, along with an interrogation team. He'd apparently had enough of Djibouti and had forward-staged with the bird. He was in constant contact with Kurt in D.C., and I'd spent the 30-minute flight on a headset, giving Kurt a verbal report on everything that had happened. Well, everything pertinent to our mission. The last I'd seen of Johann was taxiing down the runway in Lesotho. I had no doubt that Thomas needed the help, but I was a little sad to see Johann go. He'd ended up being a pretty solid guy, despite his seriously flawed employment decisions, to include his interrogation of Aaron. That mistake had almost cost him his life. But if he could keep Thomas breathing, I'd call it a wash. We landed in Joburg, and the first order of business had been sleep. I'd left Armstrong in the capable hands of Blaine and his crew, given the team their marching orders, and gone comatose for close to 16 hours. When I'd awoken and padded down to our hotel talk, Blaine was talking to Kurt, and Kurt was in a fine mood. Turned out there wasn't any danger to the hospital, and he'd burned a lot of chips to get the ball moving, all because he'd agreed to let the coup go forward and felt responsible for the threat. Now he was learning there had been no threat to the hospital, and he'd managed to convince the Secretary of Defense to execute a full-blown NEO, based on my recommendation. He started right in as soon as I sat down. "You told me the hospital was under fire. Now, wait a minute. I told you it was uncorroborated. And conveniently, some guy named Thomas Naboni is now in charge of the country. The king's come forward supporting him, which was enough to shut down any bitching by MPs in Parliament. Not to mention there's some rumor that a U.S. Special Forces team had something to do with keeping him alive. Like some kind of Karzai mission in Afghanistan after 9/11. Because of it, the U.S. Embassy is scrambling for a story supporting his rightful position in the government. Why are you shouting at me about this? You said yourself, if Thomas was left standing, it wasn't any of our business. An SF team? Really? His eyes started to bug out of his head and he shouted, "It's the same damn team we talked about! They were gone before I even made my first call!" Well, you might want to ask the embassy RSO about that. He clenched his fist and sputtered, "I did! Two women showed up at the embassy and convinced the team to leave!" "Yeah? That's so? Strange." "Pike?" Before he could get too worked up, I changed the subject. "Did we get anything out of Armstrong?" He let out a breath and sagged back, saying, "Yeah, he's setting up a meeting between Malloy and that Colonel Smith guy. We're transferring control over to DSS and FBI, and they're coordinating on a sting with the South Africans. It's a law enforcement matter now." "So you got what you wanted. Those triggers will be off the street, and Malloy will be in the bag." "And you got Thomas Naboni?" "No, sir, I got Aaron. The Israelis thank you. Thomas was just a Benny that worked out." He said, "The mission was the nuclear triggers." I said, "The mission was bigger than just the triggers." He shook his head and asked, "What would you have done if I'd have said no on recovering Aaron?" I thought about it, then simply said, "The right thing." He didn't probe what that was. And a day and a half after that, Jennifer and I were having lunch with Aaron and Shoshana, four tables over from Tyler Malloy. I said, "You guys should really try one of these hurricanes. They're delicious." Shoshana said, "I don't drink anything that comes with an umbrella." "Well, you get to keep the glass." Jennifer said, "So you guys fly tonight?" Aaron said, "Yes. We have an appointment in the Diamond Exchange tomorrow with one Eli Cohen."
"Does he know about the coup results?"
Shoshana said,
"I honestly don't care."
She put a chip in her mouth and said,
"Say, you guys should come visit before you go home."
I laughed and said, "What, you need help with Eli?" She grew cold, saying,
"No, we won't be needing any help there."
Jennifer said,
"What are you going to do with him?"
Aaron took a sip of his beer and said, "Nothing. Well, I'm going to give him a handgun, and then an array of unpalatable options. I'm pretty sure whatever happens to him will be at his own hand. Especially if it keeps his family's seat on the exchange." I said, "Well, good of you to give him a choice." Jennifer slapped my arm, saying,
"Pike."
Shoshana said,
"No, he's right. It's a choice he never gave us."
I changed the subject, saying, "Israel's a little out of the way for us." Aaron took the shift, wanting to get away from the earlier conversation. Not really. You stretch it a little bit, but you have to fly to Europe first anyway. It's just bending the leg of the triangle. Before I could say anything else, Tyler Malloy stood up, shaking Smith's hand. I called out to Knuckles, saying, "He's on the move. Get it on tape." The Hard Rock was located in a patch of concrete called Nelson Mandela Square, just off the rail line in the Joburg suburb of Sandton. It was a chic place surrounded with art galleries, museums, and restaurants. It was pedestrian only, which made it easy to box with my team for a follow. Veep, Brett, and Knuckles were positioned outside, lounging wherever they could find spots that covered the avenues of egress. I heard Knuckles say, "I've got him. He's coming my way. Veep, blood on me." We huddled around the tablet in front of Jennifer, while she manipulated the camera view until she had Knuckles' feed. We saw nothing for a moment. Then Shoshana pointed to the upper right of the screen. Tyler Malloy came into view, walking rapidly by Knuckles. Knuckles stood, and we got a perfect view of Tyler's back as he walked toward Maud Street and the Sandton Convention Center. Jennifer glanced up, then hissed, "Colonel Smith." We all looked at his table and saw it surrounded by men in suits. Whether they were DSS, South African Special Branch, or FBI, I didn't know. But it was a little sweet justice seeing him frog-marched out the back. We returned to the screen, seeing Tyler had entered an alley. He approached a van, pulled out a key, and opened the back. We couldn't tell what he was looking at, because Knuckles held back at a distance, not wanting to interfere with the inevitable. Tyler crawled inside the van and began manipulating a trunk. He got it open, and then all sorts of hell descended on him. The van assaulted by a full squad of guys wearing black balaclavas and carrying MP5s. The camera went crazy as Knuckles retreated, calling, "Jackpot, jackpot, did you get it?" I said, "Yeah, we got it." Sort of anticlimactic, though. I was hoping you'd join in and kick him once for Aaron. Knuckles laughed and said, "See you back at the hotel." I looked around the table and said, "Well, that's that." Shoshana stood and said,
"We'd better head to the airport."
Jennifer said, "Your flight doesn't leave for a few hours."
"Yeah, but I don't trust being this far away. The rail has an express straight to the airport, and I feel safer once I'm there. That place is a nut house."
Aaron pulled out his wallet and said, "Let me get this. It's the least I can do." Jennifer said,
"No, no. It's our gift to you."
Shoshana said,
"Big spender."
I laughed, and she said,
"Come to Israel. I'll give you to a gift."
"What?" She looked at Jennifer and said,
"A date. Jennifer's been wanting one for a while. I can feel it."
I said, "Oh, so now you're giving us relationship advice." Deadly serious, she said,
"Yes, I am. Take it."
Jennifer looked at me with a tinge of longing. I said, "So you're now reading us like the enemy?" Shoshana smiled and said,
"No, Nephilim. You will never be the enemy. I'm just telling you what I've learned."
Aaron rose and she took his hand, saying,
"What you two have taught me."
I rose as well and kissed her on the cheek, saying, "Can we go to Caesarea and look at pottery shards? I promised that a few days ago, and it seems to get Jennifer hot." Jennifer smacked me on the shoulder, then gave Aaron and Shoshana a hug. Shoshana said,
"We'll do what Jennifer wants, but I don't think it'll be about pottery shards. You don't have to be me to read that."
Acknowledgements. Operator Down is the first book I've written where I began with a blank slate and a plan instead of relying on a news story to spark an idea. I have gone from furiously typing 2 books a year to having some time to actually ponder. And I used it. I wanted something different. I wanted to move away from trying to chase the latest headlines and just type a story that resonated. That required doing something I've never done before, finding a story that would never make the U.S. news cycle, but was still real, which was liberating. At the outset, I had 3 goals. 1, make it personal by some world-ending terrorist attack. 2, bring back Aaron and Shoshana, just because I love them. And 3, set the story somewhere I hadn't before. From there, I started kicking ideas around that could satisfy those 3 parameters. I hit upon the diamond trade in Israel, and the connection to the plethora of diamond mines in Africa. The idea of a coup began to form, but research into the usual places where blood diamonds are found, such as Sierra Leone, revealed that these were definitely not locations I was looking forward to visiting. I then found the unique land of Lesotho, a country completely surrounded by South Africa, source of some of the largest gem-quality diamonds on Earth, and, while relatively stable, also a place with a history of coups. So, I had an idea, and I took off on my book research adventure. Only this time, I got a little more than I bargained for. After spending a few days in Joburg and Cape Town nailing those areas down, yes, the manager of the Hard Rock was from Texas, I met my guide, Kabiso, in Lesotho the first night of arrival, and we planned out the next day's events. What we didn't plan for was getting detained by a counterintelligence unit for spying on the Lesotho Special Forces base. After driving around seeing all the specific places I'd requested, we were rolled up outside of the Makonyane military base, doing things the average tourist would not. We spent the next 6.5 hours in solitary interrogation in separate rooms, which I probably deserved, since I seriously looked like a spy. The book was about a coup, so all the pictures on my camera were decidedly not touristy. The Parliament building, the Prime Minister's residence, a blurry frame taken as we drove by it, with a sign saying, "No pictures," in the picture, the lone television and radio station, the primary police headquarters, etc. Nothing on my camera was helping my tourist story. I had no plausible reason for having taken those photos. I had a retired military ID card, and there was absolutely no way I was going to tell them I was a writer and have them Google my bio. They'd already told me I'd been trained to resist interrogation. Yeah, true, but how do I answer that? And had called my passport fake because it said I was born in Japan. No idea why that makes my passport fake, but you don't argue with the interrogator. I was sure that if they saw my books and bio, it would have cemented their paranoid fears. Oh, and there was a U.S. Special Forces team on the ground conducting a security assessment of the U.S. Embassy. But they were truly there for a secret reason that I alone knew. At least, that's what my interrogators told me, because they thought I was spying for them. In the end, the Johann interrogation scene wrote itself, with a little literary license. Nobody ever laid a hand on me. But the frog is real, and I enjoyed giving him some just desserts on the page. And the plot developed with some real-world intrigue that my interrogators managed to let slip during my questioning. I had no idea at the time about the machinations occurring in Lesotho, but everything I learned during that session played out in the book. I'm deeply indebted to Kabiso, who could have left me high and dry, but instead became a little spitfire demanding we be released, and who also turned out to have some highly placed friends in the government. After the interrogation was over, Kabiso's sole worry was that I'd give her a bad TripAdvisor review. I laughed and said, "They were stupid enough to take us on the base. Can't get any better research than that." Yes, the building that Brett and Johann assault is real, as is the sheet-draped room I was interrogated in. But the only reason I saw it was because I was careless. The next day's activities were decidedly more routine, driving to Marija and seeing the museum, with a side trip to a certain concrete bridge that Johann crosses. And I thought about going to the U.S. Embassy to let them know that any SF team on the ground needed to watch what they did. But in the end, I just drank a beer at the hotel bar. They were on their own. In Israel, I'm indebted to my guide, Avraham, who showed me around Tel Aviv. Not only did he give a first-rate historical perspective on the establishment of the city and the country of Israel, but by the end of the tour, he'd finally decided I was trustworthy. Probably because when he told me about the prison that held Eichmann, I'd relayed I knew all about his capture. A little Jennifer coming through. Sometimes reading history pays off. I'd initially explained what I was doing there, and that I really would like to talk to someone about the diamond exchange. We finished the tour, and he said, I have a cousin who works inside the exchange. Would you like to meet her? 2 hours later, I had a call from her saying to bring my passport and no weapons. I assumed that was some Israeli comment made because she believed every American travels with a pistol in his belt. And I thought I was just going to pick her brain at a coffee shop near the exchange. But when I arrived, she'd gotten me clearance to get inside. Yes, I now have a badge for the fabled Diamond Exchange of Israel. And the education was incredible. So much so, I named a character after her. Alexandra is the name of the cousin who walked me through. I still have the badge. And my wife says we're going to use it. For something she has yet to outline. As in the task force and life, time marches on in the publishing industry. Retro retired in this manuscript, and my editor, Ben Sevier, moved on as well. He's been with me since One Rough Man, and we brainstormed the plot for Operator Down, argued about the title, and generally did everything we usually do. And then, while I was deep into it, he was offered a job he couldn't refuse as the publisher of a major house. For the uninitiated, that's like being offered the position of CEO. He'll be greatly missed. But my Dutton task force marches on, with Jess seamlessly continuing to berate me on editing. Liza churning out publicity leads, and then forcing this reluctant author to step up, and the rest of the Dutton crew running like a well-oiled machine, making sure my books are the best they can possibly be. As Pike would say to Shoshana, I'm glad you're sweet on me. This is Rich Orlow. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Operator Down by Brad Taylor. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Karen Jaconsky. Text copyright 2018 by Brad Taylor. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.